This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Jabadidwe.
Greetings.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Israel, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
Well, the big story this week is that in the Middle East, a state-to-state conflict has erupted that marks a turning point in the volatile region's geopolitics. For this, we'll go to our man in the Middle East, Brent.
Yeah, this really is a war that's been going on or ongoing for quite some time between Israel and Iran. But really, the cover has been blown off this war the past week or two. There were several attacks over the previous weekend with Israel targeting an Iranian and Hezbollah force that were preparing to launch a explosive drone from Syria into Israel. And that was given a lot of press over here. And the IDF decided that it was going to publish a lot of details, the people that they killed. It published some photos of how they came to Syria, showed photos of them being transferred from Lebanon because they belonged to Hezbollah to Iran for training and back. And then had footage of them actually preparing to fly this drone. And so there was that. There was also a couple of drone strikes that took place inside southern Lebanon and even close to Beirut. In Beirut, the Hezbollah headquarters there, there was a drone that was used by Israel to attack a couple of trucks, and one of them was carrying a machine that's very important in the production of precision-guided missiles. We know of the precision-guided missile technology that is being used by Hezbollah right now at Iran's behest to create these weapons that turns basically their missiles into a guided system so that it isn't just firing a missile, but actually they can hit what they want to hit in terms of all of Israel. We know that Iran has been and Hezbollah have been working together in this for quite some time. So there was that attack. There was also another attack in western Iraq where another of Iran's proxies was targeted by airstrikes by Israel, it seems. And a lot of people were killed in this. That is a proxy of Iran. And so what's interesting about this isn't the fact that necessarily I think that they took out that Israel acted in this way, but it's that Israel now deems it appropriate to show the world and tell the world that they are fighting against Iran in these different arenas, and they're going to be more vocal about it going forward.
So it's become more overt just in the last couple of weeks. I read through some reporting and analysis about this from the Wall Street Journal's Jonathan Speier, and he doesn't shy away from calling this an actual war, but he is careful to add that it's a 21st century type of war, which kind of differentiates it from the sorts of wars that we've seen in earlier eras. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's a war between state actors now, and that is what has changed. I would say that before, up to this time, the past half decade, you've had these internal wars where you had sectarian violence within countries, the Syrian civil war, the fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, and those fights have kept Iran's proxies quite busy because they have actually supported Bashar al-Assad against enemies within Syria and supported the Shiite militias in Iraq against the Islamic State. Now you have this situation where the Islamic State is gone in both Iraq and Syria. And so what are the Iranian proxies going to do? Now they use their resources and the gains that they made in those countries to fight against Israel. And so while this is different in terms of it's not a nation invading another nation, we need to see this, and as Jonathan Speier brings out in this article, we need to see this whole swath of territory from Lebanon to Iran as stages for the Iranian-Israel war. And it's not because Israel is fighting in terms of their ground troops are there in those countries. It's because Iran has its forces in those countries. And for the longest time this has existed, Iran has had a proxy force in those countries, but not the ability to direct them at will. these are no longer states that operate independently. Syria doesn't, Iraq doesn't, Lebanon doesn't. They might have official apparatus or the official government there that pretends to, or that does work out the details of living for the civilians, but Iran has the opportunity and the ability to fight against Israel from those lands. And so I think Jonathan Speier says this great. He says this very well in his article. He says, Iran treats this entire area as a single operational space, moving its assets around at will without excessive concern for the national sovereignty of the governments in Baghdad, Beirut, and Damascus. This is powerful. This is Iran acting in other states to further its own ambitions. And while it isn't a war that we would think of going back to the 20th century, there is the danger that it could break out into a war such as that. This is what he says to conclude his article. So this is a war between Israel and Iran prosecuted over the ruins of Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, but it won't necessarily stay that way. A single kinetic and successful Iranian response to Israel's airstrikes could rapidly precipitate an escalation into a much broader contest. State-to-state conflict has returned to the Middle East. And so the danger is that with Israel's attacks, that the Iran might become extremely successful against Israel, and then Israel be forced to retaliate in a much more forceful way.
So this is really a clear proof that Iran is taking over the whole region there, or at least large swaths of it in the Middle East. Could you place that development in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Yeah, that is the whole point here of why Israel is coming public on this. They're sick and tired of people saying that they're making this up, that Iran they're fighting against Iran across the Middle East, and they say, okay, well, we had three strikes this week. These are the people that died. Here's pictures of them over in Tehran working with the Quds Force leader Qasem Soleimani. Here's the Iranian officials that are in Lebanon right now working out the precision guided missile systems on Hezbollah's missiles. And so in a way, Israel is exposing the power that Iran has right now across the Middle East. And while it's doing that, it's also bringing to light Bible prophecy, because we've said that Iran is going to grow into an empire, a kingdom at least, and it's going to rule over the territory definitely of Iraq and use that territory to then gain more power and use it as its military. And so Israel has done a wonderful job, not just to trying to defeat definite imminent threats that it faces from Iran, but it's bringing to life Bible prophecy, showing the entire world that the King of the South mentioned in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 is here. Iran leads the King of the South. He's going to gobble up nations such as Iraq and others and use them to push at the rest of the world. And Israel is exposing that with these strikes.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. And we'll be sure to leave a link to Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's booklet, The King of the South, which puts all these developments in the context of Bible prophecy in a lot of very compelling detail. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Well, there was big news on the Brexit front this week, with Britain's freshly minted Prime Minister Boris Johnson asking Queen Elizabeth to approve a measure to prorogue Parliament. To tell us about this and what it means for Brexit proceedings, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, I love that everybody's talking about this archaic term now, proroguing Parliament. At the start of the year, I was reading Churchill's biography of Marlborough, and this word comes up all the time in that, but it's the first time I really remember seeing it. And it's a procedure that allows the executive, and especially the monarch, to control Parliament to a certain extent, to have Parliament not sit for a time, and that way then they can get Parliament off their back. That was in the early 18th century, and it's not really in the modern political vocabulary, and now everyone's talking about it. And what this is Boris Johnson announced that Parliament will be prorogued somewhere around September 10th until about October 15th. So Parliament's going to be suspended. During that time, they can't have any business. Now, Britain is set to leave the European Union on October 31st. There's a lot in Parliament that don't want that to happen. And there's a huge number that pretty much, well, a majority at least in terms of where they voted in the last referendum that want Britain to stay in the European Union. In the wake of the referendum, they already approved Britain leaving the European Union. It was kind of hard, you know, right after the referendum to have the people vote one way for Parliament to then not approve that. So they rubber stamped it back then. Mm-hmm. Now they want to change their minds. Now some time has passed. They want to override what the British people have said. And they want to say, actually, that referendum, yeah, we didn't mean it. We're not leaving the European Union. But they've only got until October 31st to do it. So they've already, that was kind of a tight schedule, and there was lots of shenanigans. The Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow, he said basically that he's seeing the British Constitution as more guidelines than rules, and he has been bending those rules quite a lot in recent times to try and stop Brexit. But then by proroguing Parliament and by saying, well, we're not going to meet until October 15th, and we're going to have then a new Queen's speech, this is a part of a way for the government to stop, or for Boris Johnson to stop Parliament stopping Brexit, to keep Britain on track of leaving the European Union October 31st. Now, there's a big movement among the pro-EU to portray this as somehow illegitimate, and something that's, you know, wrong. Even a coup, there've been people calling it a soft coup. Mm-hmm. I think the most extreme I saw was the author Philip Pullman saying that basically this is a dictatorship. Really, though, this idea of just ending a parliamentary session and then resuming it is pretty normal. Generally, a parliamentary session outlasts about a year, and then it's ended, and then it begins again with a new Queen's speech and a new program of, okay, well, this is the legislation that we want to get done this year. So that's not unusual. The idea of the government proroguing Parliament as well is not all that in order to avoid a difficult situation. You know, that's not all that unusual either. So you could go back to the 1990s, and John Major, for example, he tried to he did prorogue Parliament just to avoid some awkward questions about a scandal, and he even prorogued Parliament for much longer. So you're seeing something that isn't really that extreme, but it's being painted now as this massive coup, as something undemocratic, when really the ones involved in the coup, the ones doing the things that are undemocratic, are those MPs that gave people a referendum and are now trying to take it back, that are now saying, we let you vote, you voted the wrong way, your vote no longer counts. But that's the situation where we are after the news this week.
So when you think about who this decision by Prime Minister Johnson must be rankling, you know, the Remain camp, the pro-EU camp there, the name Jeremy Corbyn comes to the top of the list, at least for me. Could you tell us a little bit about what his reaction has been to this?
Yeah, his name, I guess, to me doesn't come to the top of the list, I guess. There's been a strong tradition of anti-EU in the left. Basically because the EU is left-wing but not thoroughly communist, and they believe the EU is insufficiently left-wing and stopping Britain from becoming a communist state. Anthony Benn was the main leader of that kind of camp, and Jeremy Corbyn was until recently in that camp. He was a Labour anti-Brexiteer for most of his political life. Mm. Only since he's become the leader of the Labour Party has he made that switch, and it's been a kind of uncomfortable switch. But still, he is never one to avoid the opportunity of jumping on a bandwagon. And so, yeah, he is one of the whole chorus of voices saying this is illegitimate, you can't do this. The Speaker of the House, John Bercow, he called it unconstitutional. And then Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Leader of the House of Commons, pointed out that in itself is unconstitutional because under the British parliamentary tradition, the Speaker has no voice save by the will of Parliament. So unless there's a vote saying we believe this, the Speaker's not allowed to go around offering personal opinions like that.
So this really reveals how undemocratic many in the left are there in Britain, just as we also see in the U.S. here. What can you tell us about how this fits into the resurgence that we're seeing both in the United States and in the United Kingdom? Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has talked about a temporary bit of a resurgence, and I wonder if you could just talk about how this fits into that big picture there.
Yeah, this is the cover story of our latest Trumpet print edition. But overall, this prophecy, you see prophecies in the book of, well, Amos is a book for the future. You know, there's all kinds of prophecies in the book of Amos that have not yet been fulfilled. You know, there's talk of, like, say, the plowman overtaking the reaper, where there's just so much abundant harvest, there's not a time, not enough time to get it in. It's a prophecy of a almost utopian future, which hasn't happened. So Amos is a prophetic book, a book for the future, and it talks about a king Jeroboam, referring to Jeroboam the second in Israel. So the fact that this is a book for the future, well, it makes some of its prophecies about Jeroboam prophetic. There's an ancient aspect to them, but there's also an end time aspect to these prophecies. Now, under King Jeroboam the second, Israel had a resurgence. Israel was coming under a whole lot of attack. And then the book, 2 Kings, I think it's 2 Kings 14, talks about God saving Israel through this Jeroboam, and Israel having this short, temporary resurgence. We're seeing that in the United States under President Trump, where even just you look at the economic figures and things were going down pretty fast and they're coming back up. You see that in the way that you had the radical left doing all kinds of unconstitutional things, to the point where they could surveil on a president and try and unseat a democratically elected president, and they're being pushed back. In Europe, you saw, or in the UK, you saw Britain being increasingly suffocated by the European Union. We spoke last week about how the European Union, you're at its core, it's fundamentally against Britain, fundamentally different from Britain, and Bible prophecy talks about Europe being raised up as ultimately the power that's going to be used to punish Britain. So this European Union, it was gaining more and more power, and this German-led European Union, so ultimately Germany really gaining more and more power over Britain. Britain decided they didn't like it, they voted against it, but under Theresa May and the previous situation, we were still not able to get out from under it. Theresa May agreed to a deal that basically, you know, was Brexit in name only. It fulfilled, say, on paper, Britain leaving the European Union, but gave them de facto control still over everything. That was still holding us back. Now, though, it looks like Britain is heading for a resurgence as well. We've got a prime minister now who is willing to do what it takes, if it comes to proroguing parliament or no matter what it is, to break Britain out of the European Union and to have a resurgence. But it's critical to understand that resurgence in the Bible and anciently, it was temporary. It happened during the lifetime of one leader back then. When he died, things fell apart pretty quickly. Who knows how short it could be with Britain? I mean, maybe this resurgence will only last until October and the EU will be able to bring things down pretty quickly. I don't know. But it's a temporary resurgence prophesied in the Bible. And it's a temporary resurgence so that we can get this message out, so that we can warn Britain, so that we can warn America. And so it's something that there's a short period of time now that we can really take advantage of and get this message out while we still can, while Europe isn't putting all these kind of rules and even restrictions that they're looking at putting on free speech even and the internet. It holds that back, at least in Britain, for a period of time, and it's something that we can use to get this out, to get the warning out to as many people as we can.
Richard has written an article. It's actually the cover story of the October 2019 print edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet. It's called Making Britain Great Again, and it really just explains this resurgence that we're seeing both in the U.S. and this article focuses more on the U.K. aspect of that. So for anyone who would like to understand what we're seeing here under Prime Minister Johnson, just in the prophetic context, that's an excellent article to bring you up to speed there. Thanks very much for that, Richard. The people in Hong Kong are entering their 13th consecutive week of protests, and China is now sending some ominous signals to them. For this, we'll go to Anthony.
Chinese military vehicles have been seen moving across the border into Hong Kong in what the military said were irregular troop movements. But this actually might be the beginning of a Beijing-led crackdown after months of political unrest in Hong Kong. Now, this rotation of troops actually does happen every year, but on previous occasions, state media would release a report about them only after the handovers were fully completed. But this time around, it was the other way around. And I think that's partly because China is trying to tread very carefully following the 12 or so weeks of anti-government protests. that were triggered by a now shelved extradition bill that would have allowed criminal suspects to be transferred to mainland China. And of course, Hong Kongers wouldn't have any of that. But The Guardian noticed this about this latest round of troop rotations. It said that in the previous two rotations in 2017 and 2018, state media reports noted that the number of troops and equipment had not changed. This year, the report does not include that detail. It is estimated there are between 8,000 and 10,000 troops in the garrison on either side of the border. The movements come before a major anti-government demonstration planned for Saturday as Hong Kong nears its third month of mass protests. On Thursday, the organizer of the demonstration received notice that police had banned the event. So it does look like it's going to be pretty tense again this weekend in Hong Kong. And the media report from China about this troop movement said that these troops were committed to the leadership of the Communist Party and China's Central Military Commission. It also said this, and this is a quote, "The troops have grasped the ability to defend Hong Kong." It also said that the troops are determined to resolutely protect national sovereignty, security, and development interests. They will effectively carry out the duty of defending Hong Kong and perform more new contributions to maintaining the prosperity and stability of Hong Kong.
So this really shows that Hong Kong under Chinese rule is quite a drastic departure from what it was under British rule. It's really been just a dramatic change for the people that live in the territory there.
Yes, and Hong Kongers during these protests have been flying the British flag because they are longing for those times when they were under British rule. We changed in 1997 when China took over, and it's been a big change. And honestly, it's not just Hong Kong that is noticing this. There are many countries, even in Africa, that are longing for that British rule. And it wasn't perfect by any means, but there was something special about the way they rule, because it has some connections with the Bible, with the Judeo-Christian values that they used to rule that have really benefited societies. And that all has to do with the roots of Britain and America. And Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about it in a book titled The United States and Britain in Prophecy, which traces those roots all the way back to Abraham and Abraham's descendants, and God's promises to Abraham and his descendants about how these descendants would end up being these great nations that are primarily the United States and Britain today. But the Bible also prophesied that there will come a time when, after the dominant rule of these nations, that would change. The Bible calls that the times of the Gentiles, and the Gentiles are non-Israelite nations, and Britain and America are part of the Israelite nations. And the Bible prophesied, in fact, it was Jesus Christ himself who prophesied in Luke 21, that there will come the times of the Gentiles, the times when nations like the United States and Britain are no longer really controlling and ruling most of the world. And that's changing to a time when nations like China are being more dominant. And of course, we are in Hong Kong. We're just seeing what that means for societies.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. There's a lot to keep our eye on there in Hong Kong, but we appreciate the update. For the next story, we'll take a look at the frightful state of finances for many American households and just what that means for the country as a whole. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew.
Yeah, consumer debt levels in America are soaring as households borrow money in it's really a desperate attempt to stay in the middle class. the consumer debt levels, they're currently over $14 trillion. So not quite as high as the government's debt, but still up there in the double digit trillions. And when you divide that out amongst the 320 million people, actually I think it's almost 330 million people in America now, that comes out to over $100,000 in debt per man, woman, and child.
Wow.
Now, that's the wealthy obviously have bigger debts because they have bigger savings accounts. So actually trying to just get a grasp on what this means for the nation, it's actually a little more useful to look at what's the median statistics. That's the middle person. There's 115 million people richer than him and 115 million people poorer than him. Mm-hmm. But that guy, whoever he is, his household's bringing in about $60,000 of income, but he's got $50,000 in consumer debt and only about $500 in his savings account. And so you can see that as long as he has a job, as long as the unemployment rates are low, things kind of keep ticking along. You bring in your $60,000, you take out whatever you need for your interest payments on your $50,000 in debt, and the fact that you've only got about $500 in emergency savings isn't something that's keeping you up at night. Maybe it should be, because like I said, if the next recession comes, you're looking at least half of Americans are in that guy's condition or worse. And so you've got enough money for one paycheck if you don't have, or less than one paycheck, and now all of a sudden you're just saddled with this this $50,000 in debt that you have to pay somehow. Which,
so it's sounds like that's just a really precarious situation for a household to be in. Things are fine as long as the skies stay sunny, but the second a little bit of you know, cloud cover comes along, even a short bout of unemployment could totally wreck the situation there. What does this tell us about what the next recession in the U.S. might look like?
Right. Well, the last recession was actually kicked off in a very similar condition when the economy took a downturn and people had huge mortgage debts they couldn't repay. So you had this wave of bankruptcies hit the system that drove the big banks to bankruptcy and had to be bailed out by the government. That mortgage debt's almost back to as bad as it was in 2008, but actually a lot of economists are thinking that it might be auto debt or credit card debt or student loan debt that's the next trigger. Of that $14 trillion in debt, $10 trillion of it is mortgage. But you have a $4 trillion bubble of credit cards and student loans and auto debts, things that are harder to get back because you can always sell your house and, assuming you're not underwater on the loan, pay off the mortgage, get an apartment. You can't do that with student loan debt or with credit card debt. So a lot of accounts are thinking that will be the next bubble that pops and pushes the economy into a bad place. After that, it would unfold very similar, I think, to the last recession, with the exception is last time we got saved because the government came in and bailed out all these banks, so the whole system didn't come bankrupt. Back then, the government was only $10 trillion in debt. It's over double that, and now we've spent the last 11 years of good times bringing our mortgage back up as bad as it was, and over doubling our national debt, which puts us in a very bad place. One verse we've gone to a lot on this show to show the prophetic or even Christian living significance of debt is Deuteronomy 28, verse 44. It's the list of curses that come on a nation, the modern-day descendants of ancient Israel in particular, if they disobey God, where it talks about how foreigners will get up above you very high. They will lend to you, and you won't lend to them. Now, that in specific is about nation of end time Israel, America, and Britain primarily going into debt to foreign nations, and might be more applicable to like the government's debt to China and Japan of some of these nations. Right. But it's the same moral trend of spending beyond your means. There isn't necessarily a reason a median family making $60,000 a year can't balance a budget. You're definitely not below the poverty line. And so it's, you're going into most of this consumer debt is going into debts for nice houses, nice cars, college degrees, or credit card things, things that you don't necessarily need, you just want and can't afford. That pushes the nation into consumer debt, and then the same the people elect government officials with the same problems who then borrow from foreign nations. And it really does put the entire economy at risk of collapse.
Where would you send listeners if they wanted to know more about just how to have healthy finances and what the Bible has to say about that?
Right. Like I said, I think last week on this show, or maybe the week before, we talked about the article, Our Financial 9/11 Was Prophesied, just to look at the prophetic significance on the American economy in general. But for individuals, that median household income guy with the $60,000 in income and $500 in savings, we actually have a book that's more personal titled Solve Your Money Troubles that really shows how the American government could fix its economic problems on a small scale. But assuming the American government isn't going to adopt these principles, individual people can enact these biblical principles and solve your money troubles. This booklet that takes, quote, scripture, takes all these principles direct from the Bible to be able to show you how to at least get your house in financial order so you're not in as bad a spot every time the economy takes a little bit of a downtick.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories we're covering today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be there soon, along with links to Solve Your Money Troubles and the other literature that we've mentioned. So please visit thetrumpet.com to check that out. Coming up, we'll talk about German tanks once again in Poland, a heinous crime in Berlin that has the Kremlin's fingerprints all over it, the war in Yemen, and a concerning shift underway in Latin America. We'll be back in a moment.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Well, we go back to Europe now, and before we get to our other main European story, Richard, I wonder if you could just give us a little bit of an update following on what you spoke about last Friday, just to bring us up to speed on the latest developments there in Italy.
Right, so last week we talked about how Italy's government was collapsing, and that basically it seemed like there'd be two options. Either you would have a pretty fragile coalition would take over of enemies that don't really have much in common, but just don't want fresh elections, or you'd have fresh elections and this potential Italian strongman, Matteo Salvini, would end up in charge because he's overwhelmingly popular. Well, we saw the fallout from that this week. The result is, to quote from The Atlantic, Italy has gone from 1 week incoherent government to another week incoherent government. The five-star movement that was part of the old government, they've gotten together with the Democratic Party. These are two former enemies, and they've come together because both sides don't want an election. Now, the five-star movement still has to approve this via an online poll because they're kind of a new and unconventional party. So no immediate elections, no strongman coming to power in Italy right away. But as again, as this Atlantic article concludes, this new government may already have its days numbered. Salvini is ready. It doesn't look like this is going to be an effective government at all. So this is probably going to push people even more now in Italy into wanting a strong man, someone like Salvini that proved himself effective when he was in office. And so I think we're in the longer term, we're going to see that desire for a strong man in Italy only grow dramatically.
Okay, another strong man in Europe. That's an echo of World War II. And then we kind of have another World War II echo happening in Poland, where back in 1939, Poland, of course, was overrun by German tanks. Here we are 80 years on from then, and now Poland is once again on the cusp of seeing German tanks inside its borders. It's, under different circumstances this time, but still a significant development. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was really a vivid picture of how things have changed in Europe, how Europe, these countries of Europe are coming together in a united military already in several very practical ways. So on August 16th, Poland announced that it wants to join the European Main Battle Tank Project. This is a project to develop a new tank led by Germany and France. Now, Poland is already a big client of German tanks. They own a whole load of German Leopard 2 tanks. Now they're getting involved in the next generation. They're investing in this German-led project. But then more than that, Defense News has an article just this last week. Poland's search for new European tank is contagious. So this was talking about how Poland getting involved is helping to bring a whole load of other Eastern European nations into this initiative. And so Poland's allies in Eastern Europe are coming around and getting behind this quote-unquote super tank that Germany and France are working on. Now, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, he drew attention to this Franco-German project. He had an article, France rejects Germany and France rejects America and empowers Germany, and pointed to this tank to show how in practical ways you're seeing a combined European military force, and by getting behind this, France was empowering Germany. And now you see Poland, you see other nations getting involved in this very practical manifestation of a combined European military. I mean, this is one of the reasons, this is one of the things that holds Europe back right now, that every country has their own tank, has their own military project. When you have all of these get together, they have the opportunity to make something much more powerful than what they've had before. And this story is really significant. And it even ties into the Matteo Salvini story we just introduced with, where the Book of Revelation has a prophecy in Revelation 13, Revelation 17, about this coming power. And Revelation 17 describes it as a union of 10 kings, 10 strongmen, like Matteo Salvini. And we've said, we said last week, that's why this is significant. It's showing that you're having a Europe of strongmen and a desire for strongmen in Europe. You're going to have this union where these 10 kings, these 10 strong men come together, and then it says they give their strength and their power to the beast, or this overall empire. They all contribute to its military. It's a coming military power. And other prophecies tell you that it's going to be made up of the east and of the west. In Europe, they come from these different regions. And so when you see them working on a main battle tank, you see in very practical ways this military power led by Germany coming into being. Josue Michels describes this particular event in an article 80 years on. The working title at the moment, Poland Again Beholds German Tanks, and that's on this immediate story. And then we also have a trends article that you can go to learn more about what the Bible says is coming in Europe. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Ongoing Unification Project.
We'll be sure to include links to both of those in the show notes for today's episode. Thanks very much for that, Richard. For the next story, we'll stay on the topic of Germany, where a horrific crime has just taken place that has the fingerprints of the Russian government all over it. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Anthony.
Yeah, this all happened in broad daylight on August 23rd, and it all happened when this man who was making his way to Friday prayers and a suspected Russian agent riding a bicycle and carrying a handgun with a silencer approached him and shot him twice in the head at close range in central Berlin. The victim was a Chechen exile living in Germany, and he died on the spot. And he had commanded a fighting unit against Russian troops in the Second Chechen War between 1999 and 2004. And at the end of the conflict, he had moved back to his native Georgia, where he joined Georgia's counterterrorism unit and worked as a mediator. And he continued to help the Chechen insurgency and was thus regarded as a terrorist by Russia's intelligence agency. Back when he was living in Georgia, he survived two assassination attempts, and one was by poisoning, and one he somehow dodged 8 shots at him while driving his car. And then he fled to Georgia and lived there for 6 months, and then fled to Germany in 2016. Immediately after the killing, German authorities arrested the suspected assassin, and like you indicated, he's Russian, and it all has Kremlin fingerprints on it. And authorities are raising suspicions and concerns that Russia is behind it, and they are likening it, obviously, to many other attacks that are similar to this that have happened in Europe. There was one website that I found this week that interviewed the victim's brother, and they asked him whether the victim had followed any special security measures. And I think his response really summarizes the big problem that we have here. It said this, quote, "Knowing that in Georgia the Russian special forces feel at ease and that it is not safe for him to be there, he asked for asylum in Germany. Of course, he was always careful, but as far as I know, he did not ask for security guards, since he believed that the German special forces and police would not allow refugees to be killed there, and Russia would not dare to act so brazenly." Of course, the reality is that Russia does dare to act so brazenly.
So it looks like the Russian government saw this Chechen man as a terrorist, and they ordered this assassination right there in Germany's capital city. What sort of reaction do you think we could expect from Germany and perhaps from the broader European community there in response to this instance of, you know, just this an assassination in broad daylight perpetrated by the Russian government right there in Germany?
What's happening is that the relationship between Russia and Europe has been deteriorating, and it's just going to continue deteriorating a lot more, like with Russia's occupation and annexation of Crimea and those other attacks of spies or former spies that have taken place on European soil. I mean, that's a good part of the reason why Russia was kicked out of the G8, and it's now the G7 now, and a lot of European nations were in support of Russia being kicked out. So we are going to be seeing a lot more of Europe just being a lot more wary of Russia, and Russia's leader really is a ruthless leader. And it just reminded me of a Trump Daily radio episode by Mr. Brad McDonald about how, generally speaking, the West dangerously underestimates Vladimir Putin. And it reminds me also of Mr. Joe Flay. He wrote an article back in 2008 when Russia attacked Georgia. The article is titled, Russia's Attack Signals a Dangerous New Era. He says Russia's attack on Georgia marks the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. This was the first military strike of a rising Asian superpower, and there will be more. And what we're seeing in these developments is that some nations are beginning to see that, to see how true some of these statements were from Mr. Gerald Flurry back in 2008. There are prophecies that do show that Russia is indeed going to be a superpower aligned with other Asian nations. And there are other prophecies that essentially say that Russia's superpower status and its brazenness are going to frighten Europe to unite to form a superpower of its own. One good example is Daniel 11 verse 44 that says that tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him, referring to Europe. And this prophecy is yet to be fulfilled, but in a sense, as Mr. Fleury explains in his article, the fulfillment of this prophecy is already occurring in embryo today. So that's the significance of Russia's brazen attacks on German soil in Europe, and it's not going to be a good outcome for either one.
We'll be sure to include in our show notes a link to Mr. Fleury's article from 2008 called Russia's Attack Signals a Dangerous New Era. I think this assassination and many others along the same lines as this one show that we really did enter into a more turbulent time thanks to Vladimir Putin's Russia starting in 2008. And also a link to his article called Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy, which really just proves that Europe's fear of all this activity we're seeing in Russia, all this belligerence, is one of those catalysts that's hastening the unification of the European nations. Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. For our next story, we return to the Middle East, where after 4 years, the war in Yemen is still raging, and the U.S. is weighing some options. For this, we go back to Brent.
There was an exclusive report that came out this week from the Wall Street Journal that indicated that the Trump administration is looking toward having negotiations with the Iranian-backed Houthi movement in Yemen. And this is, in part, it looks because there is a fracturing of the United States alliance, at least the Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and the United States have all been fighting together against this Iranian-backed movement for about 4 years. And they haven't made much headway to this point. And so it's not that surprising necessarily that the Trump administration is trying to change tact in a way. Of course, this hasn't been officially confirmed that they're going to go ahead with this. But we did have just another meeting between U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and also a Saudi official that's very close to the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, this Wednesday, to discuss what was going on in Yemen. Yemen obviously doesn't get a lot of attention in the world, but it is a critical nation in terms of its geography. It forms the western part of the gateway into the Red Sea. And so we've had our focus on Yemen and the civil war that's broken out there, let's say in the past 4 years since 2015. When these Iranian-backed separatists, the Houthis that mainly operated out of the northwestern part of the country, took over the capital, declared war on the official government of the state, and basically started to use its territory to disrupt shipping through the Bab el-Mandab, this 20-mile wide strait that is the gateway to the southern Red Sea. And if it's the gateway to the southern Red Sea, it's the gateway to the Suez Canal and the Mediterranean for all transit from Asia, including the Persian Gulf. So it's critical that this thoroughfare remains open, and yet we have seen that trade be jeopardized by the Iranian-backed Houthi movement, as well as the Houthis have used this territory now to wage war on Saudi Arabia. It's almost daily, although you don't hear it reported, that ballistic missiles get fired from Yemeni territory into Saudi Arabia, flying hundreds and hundreds of kilometers, civilians dying, attacking international airports in Saudi Arabia and even the UAE. This is happening so often that it doesn't even get reported now. But we do see, in a sense, because the United States looks to be open to these talks, that the U.S. doesn't want to fully support Saudi Arabia's mission here, and might be willing to strike a deal with Iran.
So the U.S. hopes to bring Saudi Arabia and some of these other nations to the negotiation table, maybe to get some peace talks started. Do you think there's cause for optimism here?
Well, there's the offensive has stalled. So it's always the case, unless you're going to put forward a lot of force, it's going to be very hard to defeat grassroots movements of people that are well armed, unless you're willing to go over there and fight hard. And the United States has mainly done this through support of the Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The UAE has their own vested interest in supporting a different Yemeni government to the south, and so they've slowly pulled out of the Saudi Arabian alliance. And so the US is right now deciding what to do. There's no support for the Yemeni war in Congress, no support in the Senate. It's one of the rare bipartisan issues where the United States president has vetoed resolutions from the government, from at least the House of Representatives and the Senate, to pull out American support for this war. And so the U.S. is kind of stuck between a hard place right now, a rock and a hard place. The U.S. does not want to go in hard in the Middle East with troops, no longer. It's got 5,000 in Iraq. Another couple thousand in Syria, doesn't have any troops on the ground in Yemen, and wants to do it all from afar. And if the allies of the United States can't get the job done, then there must be another way forward. And these are the peace negotiations, I guess, that are going to be going worked out here soon.
Could you place this in context for us in terms of Bible prophecy, and also just let listeners know what they could read to better understand that?
The article people can read is up on our website right now. It's entitled "Houthi State of Yemen Coming Soon." It was written actually just before we had the revelations that there was some type of peace deal coming out, or at least negotiations. It was written by Warren Reich, and it goes through why this area is prophetically significant. We know that Iran is going to control vital sea passageways based on the prophecy found in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40 to 45. And the passageway at the Red Sea is one of those that Iran will control. And so as he wrote there, and as we have been writing, Iran is not going to give up on its presence in Yemen. And if we've got a negotiation going forward for some type of peace deal, which will have a Houthi state there, border as one of the gatekeepers to the Red Sea, this would be a direct fulfillment of those prophecies, preparing Iran to control this choke point of world trade. Again, they can read this article, "Houthi State of Yemen Coming Soon."
Well, thanks for filling us in on that, Brent. For our final story today, we'll go to Latin America, where the people are souring on the idea of giving a political voice to all citizens. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew.
Discontent against democracy is growing in Latin America. They actually had a poll taken late last year by the multinational polling service Latino Barometer, which found that only 48% of Latin Americans polled said they definitely favored democracy over authoritarianism. So less than half that say that democracy is for certain the best form of government options available to them.
So they seem like, you know, they would prefer a strongman. They would prefer dictators and despots.
Yeah, actually another 28%, so almost a third, said that indicated that authoritarianism can be preferable, at least in some circumstances. And now the strongest support for democracy came from Venezuela, because absence makes the heart grow fonder. But the weakest support was coming mainly from nations like Brazil, Mexico, and Central America, nations that are being beset by corruption and drug violence. A lot of the political analysis of this really puts a lot of emphasis on the illegal drug trade that they're has caused so many problems in these nations that, like you said, they're actually kind of looking for a strong man who can come in there and violate some drug cartel human rights.
So they sort of feel like they're present democratically elected governments are anemic and they're not strong enough to really deal with these crises effectively.
Yes. The Latino Barometer poll didn't necessarily delve too deep into the reasons for their answers, but putting it together with other trends in the area, that definitely seems to be what's happening here. And quite prophetic as well. Just because we've got an article up on the website now entitled "Latin America is About to Abandon Democracy," and it covers a prophecy in Revelation 17 about 10 kings or authoritarian leaders who are prophesied to rise on the scene in Europe in a revived Holy Roman Empire. But it was the Holy Roman Empire that initially colonized Latin America. And so the economic, religious, and linguistic ties between Latin America and Europe have always been strong. And now with this this new trend towards authoritarianism, which we're already seeing in the polling data in Latin America and in Europe to an extent as well, definitely prophesied to get stronger in Europe, does show that these regions are going to have a much stronger alignment in the future as Latin America turns away from American-style liberal democracy more towards this authoritarian-style European government. Brazil is one of the lead nations in Latin America and also one of the nations where this trend towards authoritarianism is growing, with 41% of the people there saying that democracies aren't essential to a nation. The current president, Jair Bolsonaro, is not an authoritarian himself. He's a democratically elected president. But he has reinstated celebrations or commemorations of the 1964 coup that ushered in a 21-year military dictatorship. Mm-hmm. So even he has a soft spot if conditions get bad enough for authoritarian measures, saying that this dictatorship did some things that he thinks are worth celebrating in Brazil. He's also being advised on foreign policy by Prince Luiz Philip Orleans de Braganza, who is a member of the deposed Brazilian royal family, a descendant of the last emperor of Brazil, a descendant from one of the Holy Roman emperors, and not necessarily him himself, but his uncles are very involved in the Brazilian monarchist movement. There's a, and they're actually very excited about Bolsonaro's election, saying that this could be the first step towards the restoration of the Brazilian monarchy, which was closely related to the monarchs of the Holy Roman Empire. Don't necessarily know if that's going to happen, but it does show that there's definitely some people in very high positions who are quite sympathetic towards either military dictatorship or monarch related to the Holy Roman Emperor, or other options of government than congressional democracies akin to the United States or Britain.
Yeah, so it's easy to see how this Latin American yearning for despotism, at least among parts of the population, could help to align the region with the Europeans there in the months and years ahead. Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Please visit us at thetrumpet.com to read more about the stories we're discussing today and to subscribe to our print edition and to our email news brief. Please send any questions or comments about today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. And thanks to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadwe, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks also to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And we'll leave you with the words of Naheeb Mahfouz, who died on this day back in 2006. He said, "You can tell whether a man is clever by his answers. You can tell whether a man is wise by his questions." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.